Hey folks, hope you're having a good week so far. Today is part two of a two-part series on canoes. We're talking to an expert, Steve, who Kurt interviewed back in 2015. So this is a pretty old episode, but based on the downloads, y'all really liked it. So it was one of the most downloaded episodes we've ever had on the first day, which was cool to see. So hoping this one does as well too. But Steve is a great storyteller, very informative, a guide, and is very passionate about canoeing and about the waters that we canoe in. So the second half of the conversation talks more about canoeing as well as Steve's passion for the boundary waters and saving them around Lake Superior from mining. So I know that we deal with that here where I'm from, phosphate mining, and up there I think it's like copper ore mining or something like that. So we're going to hear about that. But if you haven't, go ahead and check out part one. Hope you enjoy. Let's go ahead and jump in.
Well, Steve, I grew up in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, and Tahlequah is situated on the Illinois River, which is a scenic waterway in Oklahoma, and there are a lot of canoe outfitters up and down the river that let people do short float trips. You know, usually it's a single day sort of a thing, a 12-mile or maybe a 20-mile trip where, you know, there's decent current. But in Oklahoma, the water's warm, the air is hot, and canoeing is just pretty much the same as swimming. You're going to be in the water as much as you're in the canoe, and that's part of the fun. So when you're up north, when the seasons are colder, when you've got the cold water, because it's, like you said, spring or late fall and the water's getting pretty cold, we're not about swimming anymore. It's a little bit different sport. How do people need to dress for the conditions?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, spring and fall is different. For sure, in the summer, you can get away with shorts, sandals, and a t-shirt, and most people do, I think. But in the spring and fall, for one thing, it's much more comfortable not to have wet feet. So start at the bottom, waterproof boots. Guides and fishermen up here for years have just worn rubber boots, knee-high rubber boots, and they try not to go over the top. But if you do go over the top of a rubber boot, you got a boot full of water. It doesn't dry out. So what we use are neoprene bottom and Gore-Tex top breathable socks made by a company called Choda in Tennessee. They're really a fly fishing company, but they make this beautiful outfit of boot and sock that's made for boundary waters tripping. We just really stand by them. People we've gone on trips with, we sell them to them, and they say, gosh, that was the best investment I ever made. Dry feet in cold water. So they make a sock that goes all the way up to your hip. It's like a hip boot. So if you really want to go deep in the water, in cold water, you can. But I wear the knee-high one. It's tight around the top. Even if you go over the top, it just a dribble goes down into your shoe, but not very much. The shoe itself is, leaks. It's got holes in it. It's a great boot that's very comfortable and gives you a lot of support, but it has drains. So that, your feet stay dry because they're in this neoprene sock with the Gore-Tex upper, and your boot is draining water instead of just sloshing around in water. So that's what I recommend in spring and fall. And this, from there up, waterproof, sometimes you need waterproof pants. You need a rain pant over the top of your regular pants, if it's raining, obviously. You don't want to sit in a puddle in your canoe. Most of the time we're just wearing breathable pants that dry quickly, and the same thing for on the top. I like wool in cold weather, wool tops. So many great companies these days using wool that doesn't get stinky, like Smart Wool and so many others. Everybody's got wool in their line, and that feels great on a cold day. And then layers, obviously, just like you in the mountains would use, you need sometimes a puffball kind of jacket or a fleece jacket and a rain top or a wind top on top of that. We make a jacket ourselves. It's just a wind top, that's zips up tight around your neck, has a hood, Is adjustable at the bottom. It's a color, you know, it's a bright color so people can see it. It's bright red. Makes great photographs, and it blocks the wind on a windy day. It's not waterproof, but it breathes well. Lots of options, you know, from any outdoor store in America pretty much can outfit somebody for a Boundary Waters canoe trip, except for the cold weather boots, and that's a specialty item. So that's where I concentrate on cold weather, is making sure people have dry feet. We were out this past 2 weeks ago in August, and we had weather like October. We had 2 days when it was windy, 20 mile an hour continuous winds for 48 straight hours. We were on a campsite in Basswood Lake, which is a big lake, and we just stayed there and enjoyed it. We didn't try to go paddling because it's just too rough. But we had a wonderful time, and we had dry feet because we were wearing chodas. And, you know, and if you had sandals, your feet would be cold the whole time. So you got to have, you know, you got to be prepared for almost any weather if you see it coming. Usually around here in July and August, you don't have to worry about cold weather. But this year, you know, once in a while it happens. And of the six of us, I think three of us had choda boots, and we were the ones that were happy the whole time. And people who had wet feet just aren't happy at 48 degrees and windy.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's fun when you can push the season a little bit. For one, you get a longer canoeing season, you know, before the water ices up. But I think it also means in some places, I'm not sure about Boundary Waters, but you get away from crowds a little bit more when you can extend the season. And you also see things like changes in the foliage and animal behavior changes in the fall, too. So I think it would be delightful to be able to paddle more during the colder seasons. What about the risk of hypothermia? What if you do end up flipping? What kind of precautions should people take?
Well, number one precaution is don't be out in the middle of the lake by yourself when it's really rough, you know, because that's a tough situation. You know, sometimes you have to make a crossing in rough, cold conditions, and you just have to do it very carefully, get your center of gravity as low as you can in the canoe. The canoe is a super seaworthy vessel. So as long as your center of gravity is low, you're relaxed, and you have your paddle in the water, you know, you have a brace. The paddle is what is that outrigger that gives you a brace to keep your canoe upright when you get hit from the side with a big wave. So, you know, I think there's a tendency sometimes by people to pull their paddle out of the water and hold onto the gunnels. And, you know, that's the one situation where if I'm in the stern, Curtis, and my bow paddler starts doing that, that's when I start yelling. Get your paddle in the water. That's the thing that keeps you upright. Keep paddling. Keep moving faster than the waves. But, you know, the best thing to do is to be safe. Don't go away from shore. Stay near shore in cold conditions. We had one of these days getting to this campsite. The wind picked up suddenly out of the west to maybe foot and a half, 2 foot waves. They're pretty significant, really, in a canoe. We followed the shoreline to get to our campsite instead of taking the direct route, and that's the safe thing to do. It took 10 minutes longer. Big deal, you know. And I don't want to be tipped over in the middle of a big lake. Cold water or warm water doesn't, you know, it matters, but I don't want to be tipped over in the middle. I've never done it, you know, knock on wood here, but I don't want it to happen, and I'm going to be cautious about where I go and how I do it, you know. And I think some people throw caution to the wind, so to speak, and that's how they get in trouble. There's been people who have tipped over in the middle of Basswood Lake called Bailey Bay. It's a big lake. They've lost all their stuff and they swam to shore. You know, wear your life vest, obviously. Dress for conditions. But, you know, and you're in a canoe trip, literally nobody is wearing a dry suit like you might if you're a whitewater paddler in a kayak or even a sea kayaker. So if it's mid-September to ice up, which is usually around the 1st of November, those days, I just have to be much more cautious and stay near shore and don't risk anything because there's nobody around. You're right. You know, it's the best season to be out because there's nobody around, but there's also nobody around.
There's no one there to hear you scream.
No, and it's a long swim. And I challenge you to get back into a tipped over canoe and get the water out of it. It's just pretty hard to do. Not many people can do it. And unless you practice it a lot in warm water, you're unlikely to be able to do it.
Yeah, you know, I did practice it with my buddies growing up. We had a lot of fun. Like I said, when we went on these canoe trips, we were swimming and swamping each other as much as we were canoeing.
Yeah.
And we got to the point where two of us, even when we couldn't touch the bottom, we could drain a canoe and flip it and then get on the canoe from opposite sides at the same time. We learned the tricks to do that, but you have to learn it. Not everyone's going to be able to do that.
So. And hard to do in cold water when you got your boots on and, you know, your rain gear, and it's just way different. And the water and the waves are rough. You know, the reason you tip over is because it's bad conditions, and that's what makes it even harder to get back in.
So this leads me to another question. People would have the option of maybe using a dry bag. They could tie their gear to the boat, or they could leave the gear loose in the boat, and hopefully it would float. If your gear is tied to the boat and you do capsize, then it's going to be incredibly difficult to do anything about it. Am I right about that?
Yeah, that's I mean, heaven forbid we get into that situation. But what we do is we use packs that are comfortable to carry. They're called canoe packs. They're made by companies like Granite Gear and Frost River and Cook Custom Sewing. So they're nylon packs, like backpacking packs, but much looser and more rectangular and or you know, blockier, because they fit in the canoe better that way. But we line them with 6 mil plastic bags. So once you put your gear into that 6 mil plastic bag, you roll it up tight and then cinch down the cover of the pack, the flap, and cinch it down tight. That pack's not going to sink. I tell you what, that pack will float for days. And so you don't need a dry bag. Dry bags are, I mean, my opinion anyway, this is my opinion, in the boundary waters in Quetico, there's never a need for a dry bag. You know, dry bags are wonderful for your camera, maybe, if that's what you're worried about. But for your gear, you want to be comfortable on the portage, number one, and you want it to stay dry if you happen to fall into the water. And that'll be fine. It'll be absolutely dry if you have a 6 mil plastic bag inside of a canoe pack and it's rolled up tight. It'll never get wet inside. So that's number one. And I would never tie them into the boat. They float forever. So, you know, if you tie it into the boat and you're trying to get your canoe to shore after you've tipped over, it ain't going to move very well with a bunch of packs tied to it. So you just don't do that. And, you know, get the boat back upright, get back into the boat and go retrieve your packs. But, you know, and this is so rare, you know, we don't want to talk too long about capsizing because it rarely ever happens. But if it does, you want to be prepared for it. So, you know, I think that's my advice is pack everything up tight in good portaging pack, plastic liner, keep it dry, and don't tie it into the canoe.
Hey, that's good advice. I would not have thought of that, but you know, that sounds like a perfect solution for backpacking and in rain as well. Keep the stuff dry on the inside.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, backpacking, you have more options. So you can throw a cover over your internal frame pack and keep everything dry from the outside. So you don't necessarily need a big plastic bag inside. But, you know, in the canoe, that's not feasible, really. You know, these packs are large. They're made, you know, on canoe trips, you want a pack that's big enough to carry maybe for two people, two packs for the whole trip, one food pack and one for everything else. And these are rectangular or even blocky, boxy-looking packs that fit side by side in the canoe. You know, backpacking packs just don't work in canoes. They just don't fit. You know, they go underneath the thwarts, can't get them out. You know, they might be nice. And if you have a beautiful internal frame pack that you love, bring it on a canoe trip if you want to. But, you know, you'd be much better off really with a pack that's made for canoeing. And the Voyagers knew something about what they were doing years ago. This is 300 years ago, and they had packs that looked like the same thing we're using today, only today we make them out of better materials, and we also use, you know, sophisticated suspension systems. But, you know, the tump line is not a bad deal. You know what a tump line is, Curtis?
I do not. What is a tump line?
a dump line goes over your forehead. It's what the Voyagers, how the Voyagers carried all of their packs. They had no back straps. They had a strap from the top of the pack over your forehead with a pad on it, a leather pad, and they carried everything with what are called tump lines. Now, tump lines are still available for canoe packs, and you know I don't use them, but I know people who do, and they swear by them, and you know, it gets the weight on top of your head, basically, and on your, you know, and nowadays you still have, you have shoulder straps and a tump line, so you vary between carrying this weight on your head and your neck, and also on your shoulders and your hips. So it's not a bad thing, and it's a you know, old fashioned alternative that still works really, really well.
I have found that there are a lot of the old ways, they were pretty innovative, really. People solved problems. They didn't have the same technology and materials that we have, but they figured out ways to do things that just made sense.
Yeah. Isn't that true? You know, we, how many times do we have to reinvent the wheel?
But exactly.
The wheel's getting better every time, at least when it comes to outdoor gear. Boy, you know, last 35 years, and I've been in business, amazing technology has made things lighter and more comfortable. Like, take sleeping pads. Remember what we used to sleep on back in the, I mean, back in the 80s and 70s? It wasn't much.
And if it rained, it would get soaked and turn into a sponge.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. They had open cell phone pads for a while.
That's right.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible. That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode.
Well, we've talked about quite a bit of gear here. If someone wants to get into the sport of canoeing, what would you recommend for cost-effective ways to gear up?
Well, I mean, number one is I always recommend people rent the first time they go on a canoe trip and take a guide. That's what outfitters are for. That's what we do. We have all of the best gear that people can rent and try and learn from. And we have experienced guides who can go with groups, whether it's two or four or seven. You know, the maximum group size in the Boundary Waters in Quetico is nine. So that's the max. You can't have more than that. But if you have, you know, a family of four and you hire a guide through an outfitter like us and you get all the gear, you know, it's relatively inexpensive considering what the cost of the gear is. I think we added up one time with all of our gear and basically maybe more than anybody, we use the best possible gear you can buy and it's the most expensive. We spare no expense. These are $200 paddles and $3,000 canoes and packs that are $250, and we use Nemo inflatable sleeping pads that are $100 and something each. So I think with a group of six, there's something like $20,000 worth of gear that goes out. So if you want the best and you want to feel what it's like and learn from somebody who knows what they're doing, rent, don't buy the first time in a trip like the Boundary Waters. And hire a guide. A guide is, you know, it's a little bit of an extra expense. Split it over through a group of four or six. It's not so bad. And these people will teach you everything you need to know on a five-day trip that you never would have learned on your own. So, you know, everything from our guides are all naturalist guides. So, you know, and they know the woods. They know the nature. You know, there's some of these people know way more about the ecology than I do, and I've been here 40 years as an ecologist. So, you know, they're experts at this Boundary Waters ecosystem. So that's number one. Now, if you're going to buy the gear and you're going to start out, I mean, and you're going to do wilderness canoeing, and you're going to do the kind of flatwater wilderness canoeing that we do, I mean, number one is probably the, you know, you gotta realize that you're probably going to carry the canoe about as much as you're going to paddle it. So, depending on the route you pick in the Quetico or the Boundary Waters, you can portage a lot or you can portage a little, but you always have to portage. So, and if you're in great shape and you're 25 years old and, you know, and you don't care, you know, a 75-pound canoe is what we used back then, back when we were young, and and energetic and not so smart probably. So you can get away with that. But if you're 63 years old like I am now, and I'm not going to go pick up another 75-pound Grumman. So, start with a lightweight canoe, and you never have to reinvest. That's number one, and then work through the gear from there, one piece at a time as you can afford it. Packs maybe next, and sleeping pads, and making sure you have a good waterproof tent. You see people in the summertime trying to get away with kind of old and used up tents that leak, and you can maybe survive through a rainy night in August or July, but it's not a lot of fun to have you want to have something that's really good and light and waterproof, and that goes for every piece of gear in your outfit.
I think that's good advice, Steve. I know that I've been tempted to cheap out as I'm getting into a sport, but if you have that cheap, heavy, clunky kind of gear, then you can get miserable pretty easily, and you lose interest in the sport because it's so hard. But boy, the modern gear that you can have for almost any sport allows you to have so much more versatility and freedom and enjoy the sport so much more. So I'm with you. I think that's right. Rent first so you can find out what the sport is like if you have great gear. And then take the time to plan out your gear and save your money and buy something that's going to last, right? And invest in it so you can enjoy it that much more.
Right. An outfitter, if you're going to rent, who uses the stuff, not just talks about it and rents it, but actually uses it. You can kind of feel them out by asking them where their last trip was and when it was. And if you see the person, you can kind of get a feel for how likely it is that they're paddlers or hikers or whatever the sport is. Talk to people who do it, not just talk about it. And that's one of the things we pride ourselves in. We as owners and every one of the people who works here, we do. We just don't talk about it.
When you say we, let's say the name again, Paragus Northwoods. Your website is paragus.com, is that right?
Yes, it is, and also boundarywaterscatalog.com, but you can get to all of it through paragus.com.
And that's P-I-R-A-G-I-S.
That's exactly right. Thank you.
Well, I want to make sure that people know how to find you because you're giving us such great information. And I know there are going to be people out there going to say, man, I have got to get to Boundary Waters and check that out. I'm going to go to Paragus and let him set me up with a guide and a boat and the right paddle so I can see what this is all about. So listeners, take advantage of this. We love it when our listeners go to the people we interview and that community builds and grows.
Our outfitting department is run by two young men who do a tremendous job, Drew Brockett and Adam Mock. And they're the guys who get the permits and set up the outfitting gear and talk to you about routes. I'm happy to do that too. But they're the guys that answer the phone most of the time when you talk about outfitting. And they've been around here for about 10 years each, a little bit longer for Drew, maybe 15 years, and they do trips. I mean, Adam goes every 2 days he has off in a row, which is every week, he's out on a trip. And then at the beginning of the season and at the end of the season, both Drew and Adam do trips. That's what they do. They do Boundary Waters canoe trips, and they love the Quetico and the Boundary Waters.
Well, that's great. So Drew and Adam, those are your guys.
Yeah.
So last time you were on the show, which was back in March, episode number 2, we talked about this sulfite ore mine, which is a copper nickel mine that a foreign company is trying to come onto U.S. soil and do this mine that's going to be in the watershed for Boundary Waters. Something about that just doesn't make any sense. What's going on with that, Steve?
Well, a lot. First of all, it's not a mine yet, and if we have anything to say about it, it never will be, and we're making progress in that way. Our piece of the headwaters of the Rainy River Basin, and we're at the very headwaters of that large basin that eventually drains into Hudson Bay, is just outside of the boundary waters. And the boundary waters itself is part of that headwaters. But there happens to be, along the edge of the boundary waters, a geologic formation called the Duluth-Gabbro Complex, which within it holds layers of concentrated minerals that contain copper, nickel, platinum, palladium, and gold. So people have been interested in these minerals for 50 or more years. The price of the minerals rose in the 1990s and early 2000s, so that mining companies became more interested in these concentrations of copper and nickel, especially just outside the boundary waters. There's one company that we're concerned about right now called Twin Metals. They happen to be owned by Antofagasta, which is a Chilean mining company, very large Chilean mining company. They want to build a mine here, and they've been exploring for a long time. So our concern is that that mine would drain, the water coming from that mine would drain directly into the Boundary Waters watershed through the heart of the Boundary Waters and what really is the heart blood of the Boundary Waters called the Kuishui River. American River is called the Kuishui River, one of the most threatened rivers in America last year because of this potential mine on the north side of the Laurentian Divide. Two other companies are also interested, not as far along as Antofagasta is with their Twin Metals mine. So our group, which started as four couples and local people like us, part of the group that founded this campaign called the Campaign to Save the Boundary Waters, savetheboundarywaters.org. We have over 20 national environmental organizations and sportsmen's organizations who have joined this national campaign. We have grown from the last time I talked to you to a budget of over $1 million a year to fight this mine. We have 10 full-time employees. We have people all over the country working on, including a pro bono law firm in Washington, D.C. It's a big, big job, and it's a very precise and focused effort to keep out copper nickel mining from the Boundary Waters watershed. So the effort is directed at the agencies, the Bureau of Land Management that owns the underground rights. They own the mineral rights underneath the land, the Forest Service that owns the land on top, and the administration, the Obama administration, which controls those agencies. And our efforts are to try to convince those people that, first of all, they shouldn't renew mineral leases to Antofagasta. They should delay or rescind the legal right to even explore for minerals in this watershed. And the Bureau of Land Management is considering how they're going to approach that subject. Right now, those leases are up for renewal for another 10-year period. We say you shouldn't do that because you should do an environmental impact statement first to see what the impact will be to the Boundary Waters. Boundary Waters is 1 million acres. It's 1,000 lakes. It's interconnected waterways. It's a giant sponge of water with land in between. If you look at the map of the Boundary Waters, there's almost more water than there is land. But and anything, any pollution that would come into the wilderness from a potential source like a copper nickel mine would spread through the whole wilderness and destroy the ecology of those lakes. So, and it would destroy our business and everything about our business that we've spent so many years working on. So we're fighting it as hard as we can, and there's a large group of people here in this area and across the country who are as concerned as we are. And so it's a campaign to save the Boundary Waters. Listeners want to check it out, it's Boundary Waters, savetheboundarywaters.org. Right now we're working on, we've had several different events over the last couple of years to try to publicize what we're doing. We had a bike tour of Minnesota, towing a canoe behind us on a trailer across 800 miles of Minnesota, introducing the subject to Minnesotans. Coming up, starting on September 23rd, two wonderful young explorers, a couple, Dave and Amy Freeman, will be taking off in their canoe for a year in the Boundary Waters. It's called Year. It's the event is called Year in the Boundary Waters. This is not new to people like Dave and Amy. They've spent many, many months crossing Canada by canoe and kayak and dog sled. Now they're going to spend 365 days in the Boundary Waters Wilderness, moving by canoe in the fall, dog sled in the winter, and back to canoe all next spring and summer. They'll be there for a whole year, and they'll be sending out tweets and social media every day from wherever they are in the Boundary Waters. And we've got a sportsman's organization that's just as concerned as the paddlers are, because this is a big fishing area, and fishermen and hunters enjoy the forest as much as paddlers do, and especially this time of the year as we get into hunting season. But fishing year-round in the Boundary Waters is very important. So that's what, the whole reason to do this is that copper nickel mines, sulfide ore mines, as they're known, hard rock mining, and we've been reminded of this many times recently, is toxic. You know, it gets, it's almost impossible to have a sulfide ore mine and not have pollution. In fact, I think it is impossible. It may take a few years, but pollution from mining is the number one most toxic industry in America. And here we have the Boundary Waters Wilderness, the America's most popular wilderness. 250,000 people a year come to the Boundary Waters in some form or other, day trips, 79,000 wilderness paddlers every summer. So there's no wilderness that's more popular in the United States. It's 1 million acres. It's the largest wilderness east of the Rockies and north of the Everglades. It was founded in 1964 with the original boundary, with the original Wilderness Act. It was one of 10 wilderness areas in that first Wilderness Act. Hubert Humphrey, who helped write that act, was a Minnesota senator who wanted to make sure that the Boundary Waters was part of that act. And it just doesn't make any sense to put the world's most toxic industry next to what is really the world's most popular wilderness area.
Mm. You know, Steve, I am sure our listeners are aware of the big spill that happened here in Colorado, upstream of Durango on the Animas River. And I don't know the details about this mine, other than to say that there was a mine there that had flooded and started retaining a lot of water that got just really polluted with a lot of heavy metals and things like that. And the dam that was holding it was breached, and the river was flooded, and people with well water along the valley were told they couldn't even take a shower. And the fish in the river, of course, suffered. The full ecological impact of this is still unknown. But millions of gallons of these nasty, heavy metal laden waters just gushed down the Animas River Valley, and it was a prized trout stream before. It was a place of natural beauty, almost beyond compare, and now it's just been assaulted in this horrific way. We've got to be able to be responsible as citizens of the planet, right? We've got to be responsible for how we use its resources. And there are some places that are just national treasures. They should never be threatened by such a thing as what you're describing.
Yes. Thank you for making that point. And, you know, the Animas River disaster is only one of many. A year ago, August 4th, 2014, there was a breach in a tailings basin in British Columbia that sent millions of gallons of tainted water down one of the British Columbia's most prized fishing rivers, and at the what's called the Mount Polly mine. It was supposed to be an example of what can be, how mining for sulfide ore can be done right, and here it is destroying one of the beautiful, pristine fishing streams of British Columbia and a salmon hatchery at the end. So, you know, these things happen on a regular basis. It happened in Mexico in September last year. Things that we don't hear about around the world are disastrous. You know, mining of this type really should be done in desert areas where it has been done, places where there's not a water resource that can be polluted so easily. The Pebble Mine in Alaska is another example, one of the worst places to talk about sulfide ore mining. The Boundary Waters, Canoe Area Wilderness, and the headwaters of Bristol Bay in Alaska, two of the absolute worst places on this beautiful globe where you could consider that kind of toxic industry. Unfortunately, those minerals exist in these places, and the best thing to do with them is to leave them in the earth where they're safe and not exposed to oxygen and water, where they're 2,700 feet down in the earth where they've been for 1.8 billion years, and they can stay there safely. And, people talk about mining as having new technology. Well, there's no technology new about mining that doesn't involve moving tons and tons, millions of tons of rock. You know, there's no way to take a laser and extract these minerals. You dig in the ground and you pull out rock and you bring it to the surface and you expose it to the atmosphere and you produce acid mine drainage that goes into the watershed around it with the heavy metals, as you experienced on the Animas River. We don't want that to happen to the Boundary Waters. We'd be out of business. From a business standpoint, it's horrible. But as an ecologist and a person who loves the wilderness as it is, we need to keep this place pristine. Water that you can drink out of your cup as you paddle through these lakes, which you literally can do, and what we do all the time, dip a water bottle into the lake and drink it. Wow. So few places like that left in the world, Curtis, and we appreciate it the way it is. Even though we've been here for 40 years, we still appreciate it.
Oh, you bet. Well, thank you for the efforts that you're making there to preserve this national treasure. The Boundary Waters is something that just shouldn't be threatened like that. So, listeners, it's savetheboundarywaters.org if you would like to learn more information and get involved. And, Steve, I know that some people, like I mentioned before, are going to want to try out a trip on the Boundary Waters. Do you offer any discounts or promotions for our listeners to make that a little easier?
We would, Curtis, we would love to. We'd love to hear from more of your visitors and have them called Drew or Bert up here on our 800 number, if you don't mind my announcing it.
No, go for it.
Unsolicited testimonial from people up here that if you want to hear more about what we do, certainly you can call us and you can get, I think what we're offering for a first-time outfitting trip to get people up here to enjoy it is a 10% discount on our full outfitting package, which means everything, soup to nuts. You can bring your own sleeping bags if you have them and you want to, but we'll supply everything. You can come here with your suit on and tie, and we'll have you into the Boundary Waters in a couple hours with the best gear that you can possibly find anywhere in the world, and we'll give you the special discount that is available only to your listeners if you just tell us that that's where you got it from.
So if the listeners call in and say, hey, I heard about this on the Adventure Sports Podcast, then they get the discount.
Let's do it. Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate you offering to let us make that available.
Oh, that's awesome. I have to mention, the Adventure Sports Podcast is brought to us by 180 TAC, which is my company, along with Travis Parsons, my co-host. And 180 TAC is the manufacturer and seller of outdoors products. And we make the 180 stove and the 180 flame, which are natural fuel backpacking stoves. And Steve sells those stoves at Paragus Northwoods. So if you are interested in the 180 stove or the 180 flame or our Bearline Plus, Bearline utility system, Steve has all those products and you can get them from him.
Thank you so much for saying that, Curtis. You know, natural fuel stoves make a lot of sense here because if you've been on a Boundary Waters campsite, you realize that there's more fuel sitting around within arm's reach than you could possibly need to make, to cook breakfast or dinner. It's just chips of, white pine and jack pine and pieces of wood that people have left because they're scrap pieces of wood, and you can burn them in a stove like yours and never have to go out and start chopping wood in the woods or start searching the shorelines for wood. So really a super efficient way to use all the, the natural environment to save having to carry, a big bottle of gas.
Well, the other thing about it is especially the white gas stoves, leaky O-rings, spills, people that have tried to fill up a stove, never fails. It overflows. You overfill it. The funnel falls out, or maybe you don't even have a funnel. That kind of toxic white gas does not belong in the Boundary Waters, as far as I'm concerned. So
you know, we've got a lot of natural fuel just sitting there ready to use. And, you know, unless there's a fire ban, that's the only way my wife and I cook. And, you know, it just makes so much sense and saves weight. Weight's critical, and the weight, you know, the fuel is there ready to be used. You just need to gather it up a little bit. And with a stove like yours, you can do that almost without moving, just sitting in the middle of the campsite. It's all right around you.
Yep, that's the way I do it. Well, Steve, thank you very much for your time today. It's been very enjoyable learning more about canoeing, and I learned a ton. And like I've said, I grew up on a canoeing river, and I have done a lot of canoeing, but you have taught me an awful lot about canoeing and also about Boundary Waters. And so thank you for your time.
Well, I sure appreciate you calling. And you know, we got to get you out here sometime, Curtis, with your family. And this is about as family friendly as any wilderness area in the world.
Well, we'd love to do it. My son almost made it there this fall, but didn't work out. He was going to be in the Boundary Waters this fall, and I was excited to hear from him the report. But we'll have to get the whole family out there.
Let's do it. Thank you so much.
You bet. You take care. And for all of our listeners, thank you very much for your time today. And until the next episode, do get out there and have some fun.
First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.